I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. 70 plus years after the end of World War II, we are still struggling to understand how Adolf Hitler came to power in Germany and was able to cause so much death, so much suffering and destruction. Our guest, Thomas Childers, one of the country's leading historians of the Second World War, contributes to our understanding with his new book, The Third Reich, A History of Nazi Germany. He traces Hitler's improbable, brutal, and terrifying rise to power in the 1920s and 30s and the economic, political, and sociological conditions that led to the horrors of the Nazi regime. Thomas Childers recently retired from the University of Pennsylvania and joins us once again on Radio Times. Nice to have you back with us on the show.
Well, it's a real pleasure.
The German-American Bund was founded during the same time period by Fritz Kuhn, who was a Hitler loyalist. The organization held parades and rallies, wore SS-looking uniforms, organized summer camps to indoctrinate children, and held views similar to those in Nazi Germany. A rally of 20,000 Nazi sympathizers held at Madison Square Garden in 1939 spelled the end of the Bund. Joining us is Arnie Bernstein, author of Swastika Nation, Fritz Kuhn, and the Rise and Fall of the German-American Bund. And Arnie Bernstein, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me.
Thomas Childers, let me begin with you. And your book begins with a description of a young Adolf Hitler, a failed artist, a mama's boy, a loner, an outsider, a germaphobe, someone who failed German. When he was in the military, the leaders didn't see any particular military skills. They even wondered about his mental stability. This is always the question, I think, that hangs over Adolf Hitler, which is how a loner and, to use today's parlance, a loser become the head of the Third Reich.
Well, it is a fascinating and in many ways frustrating sort of question. There was nothing in Hitler's background, nothing, to suggest that this was a man who had a political future or much of a future at all. But one of the things that he cocooned himself so that people didn't, contrary facts or arguments, simply didn't penetrate into his private world. In that private world, although on the outside he was a failed artist and slept on door stoops and so on in Vienna as a young man, he, all this time, he had these fantasies of being a great artist, a great architect, and almost no friends. And I think friends would have punctured that cocoon. He didn't want to hear it. He didn't want to hear contrary views. So, but inside him, he was living this world. He was a maker of worlds.
A maker of worlds.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
A rich fantasy life, if we can put it that way.
Yes. He went to the opera in Vienna, stood in the cheap seats, or stood back in the back or sat in the cheap seats. And he loved the music. But he also loved the stagecraft. He paid a lot of attention to entrances and exits and how you build to a crescendo, which he put to use later.
Well, one of the things, and I do want to get to you, Arnie, but one of the things that you also write about is that perhaps he discovered and others discovered that he was a, if I can put it in quotations, a great orator. He knew how to speak to crowds of people. You quote someone who was at one of his rallies. This is describing Adolf Hitler. When he spoke of the disgrace of Germany, I felt ready to spring on an enemy. His appeal to German manhood was a call to arms. The gospel he preached, a sacred truth. He seemed another Luther. I forgot everything but the man. Then glancing around, I saw his magnetism holding these thousands as one. How important was that?
Very, very important. I mean, we're talking about a time when there was no television, obviously. Radio wasn't available to somebody like Hitler all the way through to the very end of the Weimar period. But even his most vociferous enemies, granted that the man had personal magnetism. I mean, if you're watching for an American audience or an English-speaking audience, you watch some of those propaganda films, it sounds like he's just shrieking at the top of his lungs, saying Deutschland as often as he possibly can. But there's a rhythm to it. and a speaking style. I often played a short propaganda film made during the campaigns of 1932, and he's wickedly funny.
Really?
Sarcastic. And the students in the class burst out laughing. So it's important not to slip into some caricature of him, like, you know, the great Disney cartoons of him in those days.
Let me get you in on the conversation, Arnie. And one of the things we wanted to do was to tell these parallel stories, Germany in the 20s and 30s and America at that time. How did Fritz Kuhn become the leader of the German-American Bund?
Well, he's almost like the opposite of Hitler. He's the most unlikely character. At some point, I wasn't sure if I was writing drama or farce. He was a German soldier during World War I, got the equivalent of a master's degree in chemistry at the University of Munich, and was caught stealing from his employer and fled to Mexico, and eventually worked his way to Detroit, where there was a lot of Germans working with Henry Ford at the Henry Ford complex, Henry Ford being a notorious anti-Semite.
Right.
And Kuhn got a job in the Henry Ford Hospital. There was a policy there, no Jewish doctors. Now, so it must have been some kind of paradise for Kuhn. He got involved with a group known as the Friends of New Germany. Now, a lot of these groups were outgrowths. They sort of were circling the wagons, as it were, of anti-German sentiments in the wake of World War I. And he got involved with the Friends of New Germany and rapidly rose to the top of the ranks. Now, these guys were an embarrassment to Nazi Germany. Keep in mind, at this point, we thought we might be able to work with them. You know, Joe Kennedy, the ambassador to England, Chamberlain, thought we might be able to work with them, trying to figure them out. So the word came to the Nazi command, no more Friends of New Germany. But Kuhn, for all his absurdities, realized that if the organization focused on the American aspect, they could succeed. And so thus it became the German-American Bund. He was heavy set, thick glasses, thick German accent, the most unlikely figure you can imagine to lead a movement. But he had a gift. He had a real gift for speech making. He had a genius for organization. I like to say if he had been a businessman during the 1930s, he would have been a genius because he took a wheezing, dying organization, the Friends of New Germany, turned it around, and it became the German-American Bund with several businesses, the series of family retreats, and quite frightening to, across the country.
Well, Arnie, let me ask you a couple of questions. We're probably going to get you a better phone line, but I will carry on here. What was his view then of Hitler, of Nazi Germany, and of the Jews?
He loved Hitler. He worshipped Hitler. He thought Hitler was exactly who he wanted to be. He sort of modeled himself on Hitler. But that was behind the scenes up front. He said, no, we're Germans, we're Americans. We are just trying to have our own kind of, you know, similar to like Irish Americans, you know, things like that. Deeply anti-Semitic. And they wore, you know, swastikas. They modeled their uniforms on Nazi Germany. He called himself the group didn't want their Friends of New Germany. Their leader was called President because the only Führer could be was Hitler. But he wanted to be a Führer himself, Fritz Kuhn. So he dubbed himself the Bundesführer, the Bund's Führer. He wanted to be the American Hitler.
Well, let me turn back to you, Thomas Childers. And we were talking actually before the show began about, and it should be said that not all, in fact, most German-Americans were completely opposed to Adolf Hitler and the rise of Nazism and the Third Reich and all of that. But was there evidence or were there members of the German-American Bund here in the Philadelphia area?
Yeah, there were. I mean, there are a lot of Germans in this area, Pennsylvania Dutch Germans. And so it was a natural place for a rally of German-American sentiment. I think there you would always find some enthusiasts for the Bund.
It's interesting to go back to Germany. Obviously, Germany losing the First World War and feeling very much, I think the Treaty of Versailles was called the Treaty of Shame, and the idea that they were really being punished and after a humiliating loss. How potent was that in Germany in the 20s and 30s?
Well, it was tremendous. It's what political scientists would call a valence issue, like mom and apple pie. Everybody, from the communists to the Nazis, thought that this was a humiliating, shameful act, and that the new democratic government of Germany in 1919 accepted it. So the chains of Versailles, this was an image used over and over again.
Well, and now going back to you, Arnie, now obviously there was the Depression in the 1930s, did the members of the German-American Bund, did they feel that same kind of humiliation that Germans felt in Germany?
Oh, yes. In some of the more extreme cases, Germans during World War I and the post-war era were made to kiss the American flag in the public square. We changed, the names of things. Sauerkraut became Ribbit Cabbage, that sort of thing. Beethoven was pulled from symphonies. German language wasn't able to be taught in schools, and they were generally frightened. And, they saw what was going on with Hitler and the rise of Germany once more. And it was, enlightening to them, enlightening might be the wrong word, but it was something they saw that they wanted to model themselves after.
And at one point, what was the heyday of the German-American Bund, and how many members belonged to the Bund?
Okay, this is an interesting question in that they were enormously secretive. They were notoriously bad record keepers, and they had various levels of membership. Kuhn claimed that there were 200,000, which was absurd. The FBI thought there were maybe 5,000. American Legion said maybe 10 to 15. Somehow or other, they got 20,000 into Madison Square Garden. And there was also a level of membership for those who were sympathetic to the cause, as it said, but wished to remain anonymous. So they were getting money from somebody.
Who were they getting money from, do you think?
And that's hard to say. As I say, they were secretive. There was concerns. There was some evidence that Henry Ford was very happy with what the Bund was doing. There is some evidence to suggest that Henry Ford was giving them money. It's kind of murky waters on that one, but given Ford's history, it would not surprise me.
Well, let's take a very short break. Talking with Arnie Bernstein, he's a writer, historian. Most recent book is Swastika Nation, Fritz Kuhn and the Rise and Fall of the German-American Bund. Here with us in our Philadelphia studio is Thomas Childers, and his new book is called The Third Reich, A History of Nazi Germany. And we are talking about this history, Germany and America in the 20s and 30s, obviously the rise of Hitler, and we will be talking about Nazis today. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. My guests are Thomas Childers and Arnie Bernstein. Let me go back to something that you said, Thomas Childers, about the use of rituals, rallies, certainly swastikas, all the kind of spectacle, I guess, that we associate with Nazi rallies and parades, but how that was able to cement people's allegiance to Hitler and his regime.
Well, one thinks, of course, of the Nuremberg rallies, the once a year, usually around September, beginning of September, which were just remarkable showpieces. And this is where you see Hitler always said to his lieutenants and functionaries, the issues don't really matter. They don't want that. People don't want that. But the idea of masses of people, they're really quite, if you see them in color, with all of these big red banners with the swastika in the center and the marching and so on. And then that's the show was what was important. And they tried to get this done. They had instructions for local party officials to say, when you have a meeting, this is how you do it. You put the bust of Hitler on the left. You put the swastika flag in the center. This is the order of, you know, mm-hmm. songs you sing and so on.
You're saying, I mean, in a sense, content doesn't matter. Let me quote you again from your book. Hitler and Goebbels understand that an electorate grown cynical and angry, the details, the facts didn't matter. The public, they were convinced, did not want a nuanced discussion of the issues. Nazis' promises did not add up. Their exasperated opponents complained in frustration, but they were promising everything, and people believed it.
Well, yeah. I mean, people tend to, and I think this is still true, they block out what they don't, they're not interested in or don't particularly like, and focus on those things that they do. The Nazis, basically, their opponents said, you're trying to make people believe that 2 and 2 is 5. And the Nazis, this didn't bother them at all. They said, well, if 2 and 2 needs to be 5, we'll make it 5. We'll be a triumph of the will. So in that sense, what they understood, and their rational opponents didn't, was there are times when people want 2 and 2 to be 5.
Yeah.
That if the situation is desperate enough, you mentioned the Depression. Well, for Germany, there was a hyperinflation in 1923. There was a harsh stabilization in the mid-20s. And then the Depression was the third major economic crisis that Germany had faced since the war.
Arnie, let me get you back in on the conversation, thinking about the kinds of rallies that were held in the United States at this time. How
right.
How popular were they, and what did they look like?
Not that dissimilar from what was going on in Germany, actually. Popular, well, they were popular certainly with the Bundists. They were able to, you know, pack various halls. They had their own what were known as casinos. They weren't casinos like we think of them, but more like meeting halls, things like that. They had a fabulous place in Los Angeles with a skylight and everything. They marched. They held parades. I spoke with a woman who lived in Brooklyn. She said she remembered them parading in the street below her mother, you know, shoving her away from the window so she wouldn't see. All kinds of things in public parks as well.
You know, I'm not sure. This has always confounded me, and I'll put this to you, Thomas Childers, and I'm thinking about this image of the Aryan, of the blonde child, we'll say, with blue eyes and the chiseled face and the very athletic-looking physique. Perhaps I'm talking more about a young person or a teenager. But when you look at Hitler and you look at the people he surrounded him with, they looked nothing like an Aryan.
Right. There was a joke. There were a lot of jokes in Nazi Germany, people making anti-regime comments, but in a form of a joke. And one was, yes, I'm an Aryan. I'm blonde like Hitler, tall like Goebbels, and slender like Goering, who was enormously fat.
How do we make sense of that? If this was the ideal and they looked nothing like it?
Well, there are three ways to talk about Germans in the German language. In the Nazis, there was die Deutschen, the Germans, like everybody would. But then there was the Germanen, the Germanics, and then the Aryans. And what the Nazis, when they talked about a thousand-year Reich, it wasn't that the German people in 1933 were the model for Aryanism, but that Germany was the last best hope of humanity of saving that basic Aryan blood, and that it would be the goal, the mission of the Nazis is to transform German society, which is very heterogeneous in a way for Europe, into Superman.
You have a chapter titled "Make Germany Great Again." Mm-hmm. That was the message?
Yes. I mean, it wasn't their official slogan was Germany Awake, Deutschland erwache. But it meant, and the whole pitch of the Nazis to the people was Versailles humiliated us. We didn't really lose the war. The Jews and the liberals and the socialists undid us. And so the goal of the Nazis was, this is what they presented to the public, was to revive a sense of being German. And the way they defined being German was Aryanism.
And Arnie, how did the members of the Bund in this country, how did they think of their Germanness, their Americanness? How did they reconcile those two?
There was the front, which was we are German Americans and we want to be left alone as German Americans. And there was the behind the scenes. We are Nazi and Hitler loyal. I was kind of laughing to myself when he was talking about Hitler's looks and not going with the Aryan ideal. As I said before, Fritz Kuhn was completely opposite of the Aryan ideal, and yet he was running the show. In these Nazi camps that we talked about earlier, they would march the kids in the middle of the night through brush and bramble and trying to make them, you know, strong, you know, Aryan children, and they would have bonfires in the middle of the night. There would be they'd be singing Deutschland über alles to the Nazi flag. They'd also sang something called the Horst Wieser Lied, which was the official Nazi anthem. Very much Nazi-oriented, American to the general public who were looking at them, and certainly the government who was looking at them, but Nazis to the core.
Well, you also describe, Arnie, that these camps in the United States, in many ways, they were brutal, that children were often exploited, sometimes sexually assaulted as well.
Yes. Well, the children built the camps. They didn't want to hire union workers. They were really anti-union. Now, when parents complained, they said, well, we can always kick you out of the Bund, and then you won't have anyone to look out after you. You wouldn't want that, would you? It was that fear and intimidation that kept it going. So the children built a lot of the bunkers and things like that, the cottages, the cabins they had there. There was a lot of sex abuse. It's not funny, but they encouraged the children, the teenagers, to have sex with one another. It was kind of the similar to the Nazi baby program they had, where they were, you know, produced good Aryans, and in Nazi Germany, they encouraged the kids to, in Hitler Youth, to have sex with one another, they took on that in the German American Bund. But the leaders were also sexually abusing the children as well. Mm-hmm. And when one young woman came forward, she was told basically, keep your mouth shut.
Keep your mouth shut. Let me turn back to you, Thomas.
She testified to Congress, actually, about this, too.
Oh, interesting. Let me turn back to you. I'm thinking about the Nazi families in Germany at the time. They were given when couples got married, they were given a copy of Mein Kampf. Mm-hmm. Mothers were encouraged to have lots of babies. What did it mean to be a Nazi family?
The Nazis maintained the family was the basic unit. It had to be encouraged. So on the one hand, they were very puritanical in a way. The father, of course, was the Herrenhauser, was the paterfamilias. At the same time, this ran in contrast to this basic blood sort of thing of reproduction. You can see it in the mid-30s. The emphasis on family as family, as a unit of society, shifts over into being more a biological thing. So that women were encouraged to have many children, as you said. You got a certificate if you have 3, 4, 5, 6. But also out of wedlock.
Well, but interestingly, in going back to Hitler, as you describe him, he had a morbid fear of syphilis. He didn't like, in fact, he hated physical contact, as you write about him. So raising questions, of course, about what his private sexual life was like.
Well, we don't know, of course. And there have been interviews with personal aides, not party officials, but people who, you know, made the beds at the Berghof, his retreat in Bavaria. And they were, of course, curious and were looking to see any signs of sexual interaction between Eva Braun and Hitler, and couldn't.
And couldn't.
And most everybody, I mean, there's all kinds of speculation about weird sexual practices and proclivities on the part of Hitler, but we don't really know.
That's Thomas Childers, just recently retired as a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, and he's got a new book called The Third Reich, A History of Nazi Germany. Arnie Bernstein with us as well, joining us by telephone. He's a writer, historian, and his most recent book is Swastika Nation, Fritz Kuhn and the Rise and Fall of the German-American Bund. 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get first Dave from Maple Glen. Dave, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, I just quickly wanted to make a point that among German immigrants, and there were quite a few of them back then, a lot of them were socialists. And in fact, in my own family, my great grandparents on my father's side came from Germany, and they were divided. I mean, my great grandmother was a socialist, ardent socialist, who supported Eugene Debs and Norman Thomas till she died. And her sister, my father's aunt, he remembers as a teenager in the 30s, her having meetings at her house, fascist meetings. So, I mean, it was a bitter division in the family, but an awful lot of the Socialist Party was composed of German immigrants.
That's fascinating, Dave. I really appreciate the call. And only because you're sitting across from me, Thomas Childers, you want to respond to his comment, and then we'll get Arnie to do that as well.
Well, that's very that's absolutely correct. I mean, if you go into antique store, if you go out to Wisconsin or Minnesota or up in Bucks County here in the neighborhood, and you go into an antique shop, you'll find plates with paintings of German figures, and a lot of them are socialists, you know, things about social solidarity. So, yes, I mean, Hitler only got 38% of the vote in Germany in a free election. That doesn't mean that the other two-thirds were voting against the Nazis. But it does mean that when Germans had a chance to select, they picked somebody, two-thirds of them picked somebody else. And I think that that division is something, it's not surprising to hear your caller talk about splits within his own family.
Within his own family. Arnie Bernstein, you want to add to that?
Oh, I completely agree with the caller. I'm in Chicago, and we had the Haymarket riots here in Chicago. They were German immigrants who were anarchists. There were a lot of anarchists, a lot of socialists within the German-American community, within German immigrants. I should point out, too, the vast majority of German-Americans and German immigrants wanted nothing to do with the Bund. They were a small faction of Germans in America.
Let me play, and this is a clip from a 1938 episode of a news program called March of Time, and was covering Germany at this time, and we'll just give it a listen, and then we can talk about it.
Show window of Adolf Hitler's Nazi Germany today is its capital city, Berlin. Here, the casual visitor may be surprised by the air of prosperity, the well-dressed crowd, and by the abundance of rich food served in its cafes and terraces. Nowhere does the visitor see privation or hunger. Berlin's parks and playgrounds are filled with groups of plain, cheerful people who show no signs of dissatisfaction with the fascist dictatorship which controls their lives. No apparent resentment against a government whose campaign of suppression and regimentation has shocked the world's democracies. Only those who get behind the scenes know that this outward cheerfulness is the creation of Adolf Hitler's fanatic little propaganda minister, Paul Joseph Goebbels. In the most concentrated propaganda campaign the world has ever known, Minister Goebbels has, in 5 years of Nazi rule, whipped 65 million people into a nation with one mind, one will, and one objective: expansion.
That is chilling to listen to, Thomas Childers. What was at the root of Germany's and Adolf Hitler's anti-Semitism?
Well, I don't think Germany was particularly anti-Semitic compared to other countries in Europe. I mean, if you could have dropped down in Europe in 1920 and said at some point in the near future there's going to be a horrible Holocaust, that will threaten to wipe the Jewish people off the planet. Where would that be? I think you'd get a very strong sense of, yes, Russia, of course, where the pogroms were still going on. Well, not in the 1930s, but there's a history of anti-Semitism. Or France, enlightened France, where the Dreyfus case had, in the 1890s, had been a large quotient of anti-Semitism. There were a couple of anti-Semitic riots in England in the 30s. So,
but Hitler must have been able to tap into something to create
he tapped into the
Holocaust. The
anger and fear. You know, if you have a situation where in the mid-20s, you don't know what a mark is worth. Savings were wiped out. Pension funds gone. Trust funds vanished. It cost, you know, 35 billion marks to take a subway ride, three stops in central Berlin.
The Jewish bankers did this? I mean, was that
that was part
of the propaganda?
Right. And, of course, the big business was run by a Jewish cabal. That was absolutely absurd. So was the banking. So they could play on several types of traditional anti-Semitism. The oldest form, of course, is religious. They're not Christians and so on. And on the basis of that, Jews in many places were forbidden to own land or forbidden to be a part of a guild. And so Jews had moved into a kind of middle area where they facilitated trade and commerce and banking. You know, if you there were laws which prevented people from loaning money at interest. Well, if you were in desperate financial straits and no bank would give you a loan, you went to the Jew.
Hold on to that thought, only because we have to take a very short break. That's Thomas Childers, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. Along with Arnie Bernstein, we are talking about the rise of Hitler, Germany in the 20s and 30s. Also talking about the German-American Bund in the United States. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Artie Moscoen talking with Arnie Bernstein, who's got a book called Swastika Nation, Fritz Kuhn and the Rise and Fall of the German-American Bund. Also with us, Thomas Childers, and his book is The Third Reich, A History of Nazi Germany. You can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. I'll read some comments. You can send us comments through our email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Arnie, let me turn to you and talk a little bit about the anti-Semitism in America at this time. How different was it, or was it different from the anti-Semitism in Germany?
It was different in the sense that they didn't have the laws that were put in place in Germany. This is certainly no paradise. You had Henry Ford, of course, as I said earlier, with his book, The Eternal Jew. There were places Jews simply could not go. There were, you know, restrictions at country clubs, things like that. There's the infamous story of Groucho Marx being denied membership at a exclusive country club. And he said, well, my daughter's only half Jewish. Can she go in the water up to her knees?
I remember that.
So it was here, but the laws weren't as they were in Nazi Germany. And furthermore, people could talk back without fear of being killed.
Let me play. This goes to this rally that was held at Madison Square Garden. This is 1939. And this is the German-American Bund leader, Fritz Kuhn. And he's speaking to about 20,000 people who attended this rally. And again, this was Madison Square Garden in 1939 in New York.
I heard sometimes the question, why don't you go back to Germany if you don't like the way we run things here? And I ask, who is we? Is the communists, the Jews, the 100%ers, the socialists, the Democrats, the Republicans, the Methodists or the Baptists, or the acquisitors for the administration? Are not the American citizen of German extraction included in the we's that have a right to run things here? I have never said I don't like it here, for I do, and I intend to stay here.
So, Arnie, what happened to Fritz Kuhn? And it sounds like this rally at Madison Square Garden, and there were many more people, as I understand it, outside who were protesting against this rally. But was this the beginning of the end for the German-American Bund?
Oh, most assuredly. There were 100,000 people outside. It was the biggest police presence in New York City until 9/11. That's how insane it was. Now, after this, Mayor LaGuardia, who was half Jewish, by the way, people don't know this, his mother was Jewish, he and his district attorney, Thomas Dewey, later the governor and presidential candidate, they didn't want this going on in New York City. It was a big black eye. So they started looking into Fritz Kuhn. Is there something we can get him on? Now, they couldn't get him on freedom of speech. You have the right to be obnoxious in this country. So they started looking at him in the way that the government got Al Capone.
Taxes. Taxes,
yeah,
right?
Taxes. They started investigating the Bund's books and found there were various, the little trinkets they sold they didn't pay taxes on. But Dewey said, we can get them on something bigger. They did a little more investigating. There were congressional hearings. Kuhn testified to Congress and made it sort of a little farce that he had going on, just kind of playing back and forth with the investigative committee. And the FBI had thousands of pages of files. They're all available online, kind of interesting to read, on both Kuhn and the activities of the Bund. But Fritz Kuhn basically did himself in that he was a notorious womanizer. Oh. It was a big open secret in the Bund that he was a notorious womanizer, never mind he's married with two kids. And ultimately, the feds discovered that he was using the Bund money to fund his romances. And so they got him on embezzlement. That more or less cut off the head of the snake.
Do you want to add to that, Thomas Childers?
Well, I think 1939, of course, is the beginning of the war.
Of course.
And although the United States didn't enter it until 1941, I yield to Mr. Bernstein about this, but I would think that the war would have a great deal of impact on pressures put on the Bund.
Sure, sure. An email from, Aviva. It's well known in New York City that the Bund continued to meet at Luchow's restaurant in Manhattan throughout the war. True, Arnie?
True and not. They kind of flopped along trying to get along without Fritz Kuhn. They ended officially within days after Pearl Harbor. But it didn't just go away. People were still meeting. They didn't stop being Bundists, in a sense, even though the organization no longer existed. Here in Chicago, in the German sections, too, there were also people gathered together in restaurants and things. But they weren't, in an official sense, Bundists, but certainly sympathetic to the cause.
Let me go back to you, Thomas Childers. We'll get some more callers in, and then I want to talk about present-day Nazism, if I can put it that way. One of the things that you write in this book, there's nothing inevitable about that day, about Hitler's rise to power. You talk about the other parts of the government thinking they could tame him and tame his political power, his political appeal. Did that help by thinking they could tame him, which they obviously couldn't? Did that end up enabling him?
Sure, sure. And Hitler was not elected to be Chancellor of Germany. As I think I mentioned before, the Nazis hit the high watermark of their electoral popularity, got 38%. And in the last elections, before he was appointed Chancellor, the vote dropped to about 33%. So this group of arch-conservatives maneuvered him into office in January of 1933, believing, as the Franz von Papen, who was the vice chancellor, said, we've sandbagged him.
We've sandbagged him.
Well, they weren't the last people to to underestimate him. There's a kind of teleological way of looking at this, which is first this, then this, then this, then this. But if you read through contemporary accounts, and not just in Germany, but in the United States, it's, here's this right-wing lunatic And then that shifted over into he's brought Germany under control. The trains run on time. That was about Mussolini, but it applied to Germany. So if you read, for example, letters and newspaper articles about the 1936 Olympics, which we now have come to think of as the Jesse Owens show, and it was. I mean, he was a fantastic athlete, of course. But the Germans won the Olympics.
They won more medals, right?
They won more gold, silver, and bronze, than anybody. So rather than it being an embarrassment, it was seen as a great triumph for Germany.
Do you see your book as a cautionary tale for today? Are there things in here that seem very current? Trends, ideas, beliefs,
yes.
Leaders?
Well, one thing I think the book reveals is that democracy is a fragile thing. And if you break with its traditions, you break with its practices about this or that or so on, then you put yourself on a slippery slope. And the other is that you don't need to have a majority behind you if you have a politically committed minority, 30% even, then you can do things that one would not have imagined.
Well, I think about scapegoating, if facts don't matter.
Yeah.
I mean,
right.
You know, it's a long list of things.
Sure. I mean, the Nazis cheerfully dealt in fake news. And as I said earlier, they kept being called on the carpet by the other parties, and it did not faze them in the least. That wasn't me on that tape you saw.
Arnie, what are your thoughts about, I mean, we clearly have Nazis today. Well, you can think about Charlottesville and other rallies. How do you see Nazis in America today?
It's still out there. I went to high school in Skokie, Illinois, the infamous Nazi march. That was my high school years.
Wow.
And a couple of years ago, my wife and I were shopping in the Target, and there was a guy with a swastika tattooed on his leg. They're still out there. The difference between them and the German-American Bund is they're a little more underground. They didn't hang out a shingle like the Bund did. They didn't have headquarters like the Bund did. They sort of exist in the ether of the Internet and organize through the Internet and then emerge, as it were, in things like Charlottesville. But they are out there, and they're not, you know, some sort of, you know, other. They're the people in our neighborhoods.
Well, you have a quizzical look on your face, Thomas Childers, but, I mean, they're shopping at Target,
of America. I think Mr. Bernstein is right. They're out there. They're not skinheads. I mean, there are, but that's not who we're talking about. I think the piece in the New York Times recently about the farmer out in Ohio.
Yes.
Captures that sense of they are still among us.
Right. I mean, is there a danger of normalizing that, or should we think of them in many ways as living, I mean, as believing horrific things, but living regular lives?
Yes. I think that, I mean, the Times, of course, took a lot of criticism for that piece because people thought that the Times was overly sympathetic with this man. It's very difficult if you want to talk about what ordinary people in Germany or in the United States think about Hitler, the Nazis, and so on, because you don't want to, and this is true for thinking about Hitler, if you demonize him to such an extent that he's not human, then you don't have a problem because that was that, as opposed to this is a very ordinary man, who was capable of rallying other ordinary men and women. Actually, women by 1932 made up the largest portion of the Nazi electorate. So it is dangerous, but I think for me, at any rate, the greatest threat to democracy in the world and to world peace is not coming from Germany. It's coming from right here.
Right here in the United States of America.
Yes.
Why do you think that?
Well, Trump is not Hitler. Let me say that flat out. His followers are not the same kind of ideological fanatics that you found in Germany. Attacks on the press, ruling without parliament or the Congress, really, through presidential edicts, having an alternative reality. It's not that they want to engage with the facts and argue, have a political debate. They don't want that. It's to simply declare everything that is not pro-government as being fake news.
Arne, you want to weigh in on that?
I'm in complete agreement that the article in the Times, to me, I think the Times took a bad hit on it. They were showing somebody who is, the guy who lives next door is also the Nazi. If you take a look at the comment sections on so many different websites, from things like Breitbart to various Nazi boards that are out there and do exist, to even things, comment sections like Fox News even, you will see people who have extreme ideas and are communicating with one another and seem to me be, certainly un-American, as we think of. Is Trump Hitler? No. Does he use similar techniques? Yes. He is a master of propaganda.
Right.
Let me read an email from Stu. Could Hitler have succeeded without using hate? Do you think that would have worked?
No.
No. Hate was essential?
Yeah. I mean, he had to have a scapegoat. That's the Jews. And one of the many frightening things about Hitler is that this wasn't just a propaganda ploy to whip up the masses. He believed it. He believed there was a world Jewish conspiracy that threatened the West in the world, but anger at all the failed economic policies, anger at a dysfunctional government, played on. They were masters of negative campaigning. There was a famous interview with Gregor Strasser, who was the second in command of the party in 1932, an American journalist, a woman, which is remarkable. And she said, Mr. Strasser, Americans want to know more about what the Nazis stand for. And we know what you're against, but what are you for? And he didn't turn a hair and said, we are for the opposite of what exists today.
Oh, for the destruction of the state, so to speak.
Yeah.
I'm going to end on that note because there's much more to talk about. And unfortunately, the clock is telling me that we have to end our show. Thomas Childers, thank you for joining us today once again on Radio Times.
My pleasure.
And he's a retired professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. His new book is The Third Reich, A History of Nazi Germany. Arne Bernstein, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. He's a writer, historian, and his most recent book is Swastika Nation, Fritz Kuhn and the Rise and Fall of the German American Bund. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times and you can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, listen to us on satellite radio, and sign up for our newsletter. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.